Hi, my name is Nobby. I'm alcoholic.
Nobby, Nobby.
I'm here to tell you what my life was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I started drinking at the age of 7. I drank a Miller High Life in my dad's truck coming home from Catholic Mass. He thought I should learn how to drink. But I loved it. I loved it from that day at 7 years old. I knew the taste of alcohol was something I would like to find more out about at that young age. I even knew that. It's so wild that the way my mind worked at that age, and it still works the same way today almost. But my dad, I was raised a Catholic, and I had 3 sisters. And a mother and a father, and they were divorced when I was 5 years old. They married again at after I was about 8 years old to two different people, and I hated them. I hated my step parents because I thought they were keeping my parents apart. So I had hate in my heart at such an early young age, and I didn't have any answers for my feelings. I hadn't developed anything, and nobody was teaching me how to handle things. So I decided to take that into my own hands at such a young age, and I did that by stealing things. My mother would, as my mother and father had divorced, she worked in a bowling alley and worked at a laundromat also, and I would stay there because I wasn't in school yet. And I would stay there with my mom at the bowling alley and spend a day there. And I would look to find things to do. They had a place called Mason's Shopping Center across from Southside Plaza in Richmond, Virginia. And I would walk over there as a young man and look around and window shop. And I remember seeing some paratroopers that, you would pull a string and you shoot them into the air and they would float down. So I stuck that paratrooper in my pants and covered it with my shirt. And I stole it at the age of like 8 years old. And I got caught. I got caught and they went and got my mom, and my mom was embarrassed. I was embarrassed. But this was the way my life was to go up until the time I got sober. I got caught for everything I did. And that goes for the major things also. I love my mom and my dad, and I still love my mom and my dad. I do not fault them for getting a divorce or separating or anything like that, but I do find it hard that I had to deal with such a horrible thing at such a young age. But I had to. And my way of dealing with it was to act out. And I acted out from the time of being 7.5, 8 years old to the time I was 31 and doing certain things. By the time I was 10, I had been in a detention center for young boys. And by the time I was 13, I was in a young man's penitentiary at the age of 13 for doing armed robberies, well, not armed robberies, but breaking and entering in my neighborhood. But I was doing all these things just to get attention at home because there was nothing at home for me. My parents were in upper turmoil all the time. My mom was trying to take care of 4 kids. My father was absent, so to say. And I was just there by myself to take care of myself. My sisters had their own life. I had 2 sisters that were 7 and 11. W I'm sorry, one was 8 and one was 12. And my other sister was just a little bit older than me. But the two older sisters did what they wanted, and they did what they wanted to me and my other sister because they were in charge of taking care of us. And they didn't like that. I remember that when my sister started dating and I was older, that they had to take me out with them on their dates. And they really resented that. But one of the things I remember about that is that their boyfriends would always give me a six pack of beer in the back seat of the car. And I was 13, 11, 13, 12, 13 years old about then. And I was riding around the back of my sister's car with her and her boyfriend drinking beer and getting drunk and passing out. And them going back in the woods and parking and me still drinking beer and passing out. And that's just the way my life went. I had no idea what life was about. I just drifted around through it at such an age, and I was getting whooped all the time because I didn't. I'd sass you, man. I'd tell you what I thought about you at the age of 10. I'd cuss you to your face, and I'd do the same thing to my father sometimes, and he would knock me silly. And he said, "Don't you ever speak to me like that again." But I didn't care. Pain was didn't mean anything to me. It just was a way of getting attention. Negative attention was just as good as any positive attention I could have ever looked for. And that's all I knew how to get. I knew how to get that really well. I just kept doing the things I was doing. By the time I was 13 and I was in the young man's penitentiary, I was pretty much into my own head and into my own life, and had no idea what was going on in the world around me, except that my father and my mother weren't going to get back together, and that this separation, they were one was in Powhatan and one was in Sandston, and that the only way to see my dad was when he'd come get me to take me home for the weekend. This is what I had. This is what I had for my father and my mother at a young age. Weekend visits. And these things led me to look for other alternatives to occupy my mind and to take care of my feelings, because I didn't know what they were. I didn't know how to even identify them. I knew hate, I knew anger, I knew mad, I knew pissed off. I knew all those things, but I didn't know anything about good, kind, generous, good to be around. Those words weren't in my vocabulary, so that's the way I saw my life, started my life, with no teaching or no understanding on how to sort through problems, how to sort through feelings, how to deal with people, how people could deal with me. I just didn't know what I was going to do. But what I did know is that I wanted to live with my dad, and I didn't want to live with my mom. But what happened with that was I would get in trouble at my dad's house, and then I would go to say I want to go stay with my mom. And then I get in trouble at my dad's house, and I say I want to go stay with my mom. Or if I get in trouble at my mom's house, I go and say I want to stay with my dad. And that's the way my life was. I was just back and forth, back and forth. I get in trouble in one place, I go to the other. So I really didn't pay that many consequences to my problems, because when I got into school, I was a terrible student. I failed the first grade. Yeah, I failed the first grade. I'm not the only one, obviously. And, that set me back. But, things were just going on to where I didn't have any idea what school was about, except to show up and sit down. Show up and sit down. I didn't know what they were talking about. I didn't know what they wanted from me. I didn't know what anybody wanted from me. Everybody wanted me, but nobody wanted me. My dad and my mom were fighting in the courts over me. It was the thing about the child support, all this stuff that young people just don't have any business having to deal with. Yet it was right in front of our faces all the time. My mother made sure that I knew my daddy didn't pay child support. And she made sure I thought as poorly of him as I possibly could. She spoke very badly about my dad. And that's what I heard every weekend. I remember I had weekend visits to see my dad, and from Powhatan. He was supposed to come get me. And I would sit there at the house and I'd wait after school and I'd be so excited. I'd be going to Sandston to see my best friends that I grew up with down in Sandston and get to talk to my dad and probably go rabbit hunting and stuff like that and be with his friends and just be able to interact because I love my dad. I love being around my dad. My dad taught me all the things that I knew. My dad taught me everything I know today, just about as far as hunting and fishing, not much about living. But he taught me a lot of things about a lot of things. But the things that I needed to know, I had to find out the hard way. And that was to find out in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got sober. I didn't learn anything till I got here. Nothing. Nothing meant anything. Nobody meant anything. No place, nowhere had any meaning to me. You were just another person to use. Everybody was just a person to be used to get what I wanted. And that's the way I saw my life. And that's the way I learned how to live at a young age is to use people to get what I wanted. And to use my young age to get it also. So I used the courts to my advantage. I used everything to my advantage. But when I became 14 and I committed a trespassing charge with a girl that was going to later be my wife, I got charged with trespassing and they gave me 6 months for trespassing. And they didn't give her anything. She was the daughter of a person who was well known in Powhatan as one of the families there who kind of started the county. So her father had told me not to ever come back to her house again. And when he found out we were shacked up in an old house and trespassing, he sent the state troopers and the Powhatan police over there to come get us and to lock me up. They locked me up. I remember that night so well because the magistrate, he was talking to my then girlfriend, and he was telling her all these things she needed to do and she needed to say. And I said, Monte, you don't have to tell them anything. Oh man, that set him into action. That's when he told me. He said, you know what somebody needs to do with a boy like you? They need to take you outside and kick your ass. And I opened the door and said, the door's open. I was 18 years old and I was nine and I was punk and didn't know what I was doing or saying. But yet I stood on my what I thought I was. What was I? I don't know. I hadn't developed into anything other than a lying, cheating, bad person. But I had some good traits. And from that trespassing charge, I got sent to a boys' home in Brookneal, Virginia. And it was called Patrick Henry Boys Plantation. And they knew that they needed to get me out of the county because I was going to stay in trouble if I stayed in the county. So they decided to send me to a boys' home in Brookneal near Keysville. And I was in that boys' home for 2.5 years. And they taught me how to live. They taught me how to talk to people. They taught me how to interact with the older people. They taught me how to be kind to people. They taught me how to say yes, sir, and no, ma'am, yes, ma'am. They taught me how to respect my elders. They had punishments that were a little bit different than a belt. You had to dig up stumps with a pickaxe when you did things bad at church. You just at school you'd go home and you start digging that stump up, and you spend about a week on it. But there were other things that they had for punishment. But they were more like just to do work for the boys' home to help the boys' home be a better place. You know, so when we did something bad, we wound up doing something good for the boys' home and all the boys. So we were self-sufficient in the boys' home. We were able to go to the public schools. I became the ninth grade president of my class in the school that I wasn't even a county residence. I was just in a boys' plantation, but I had a personality. I was a good guy. I liked people. I loved life and I loved music. We would play music in the stairways for elections, for people having elections in the high school, and just to just have a ball. So I got in the boys' home and I began to find my groove. And I got involved in sports, but you know what? Alcohol managed to drive its way into the boys' home and take care of the older boys were drinking. We're drinking at night at the dances. We'd go to dances on Saturday night, and the older boys were drinking, and then they were starting to turn on some of the younger boys in the cottage. And the house parent got word, and he came up there, and he picked us all up, and he had us all doing push-ups all night long and jumping jack, calisthenics. And that wasn't just the ones who were drunk. That was everybody. Everybody had to do it, and I'll never forget that. And neither did they. Because I don't remember drinking again at any of those functions. But drinking still was always in the background of everything I was going to do. It always played a part. It always screwed everything up. I don't know how else to say it because, once I got drunk, things weren't the same anymore. My perception changed. I drank essentially for the effects. There was no question that I drank. Purely to get drunk. I didn't drink because I wanted to be a nicer person or I thought it might make me a brighter, kinder, gentler person. I thought it would get me drunk and that I didn't have to deal with this shell of a person that I had become and didn't know how to deal with people. But it really didn't do anything but make it temporary. I came home one night from a football game, and I was doing acid, and I was drunk, and my mom was waiting up for me, and she looked at me when I came through the door, and she said, "Where's my son? Where's my son?" I'll never ever forget that, as I can see her eyes, it's as clear as day. She was just like in tears. She's like, "Where's Nobby?" And I couldn't answer, and I couldn't answer that to the day I got sober. Where the hell is Nobby? What is he doing? What does he think he's going to do in life? He can't keep doing what he's doing. But I never had that conversation with myself. The only conversation I had was, "Drink some more. It's going to be okay." By the time I was by the time I was 20, I was working in the penitentiary as a penitentiary guard. Because I didn't have anything else to do, and they would hire me, they'd hire anybody. And I was still drinking really hard and doing other things. And I went to work at the penitentiary as a guard for about 3 years, I suppose. And I tell you, the guards were just as bad as the guys in the penitentiary. They were smuggling drugs to them and things like that. And I remember I had to sit down and watch these guys every night doing push-ups and just doing nothing. And the thing about that is that, if something went down in one of those, they had little dormitories like this, different pods, they'd call them. And you have a pod of 20 people, 20 men in this pod, and 20 men in that pod, and 20 men in that pod. You have four. And it all come up to each other. But you'd have like 80 men to a pod. And it just was so many people and so many different things and so many things happened. I remember also being outside the gate on a night watch with a shotgun in a cabin in a little hut. With a heater in the middle. It was freezing cold. And we just sat out there with shotguns waiting for somebody to come over the fence. Here's the kicker to all this is that, later on, I became a pimp. I had 17 women working for me. And, it was nothing but the drugs and alcohol that ever, ever took over my life and convinced my mind to do these things. I just didn't ha I wasn't not this person that was doing these things. I was a person controlled by a substance. But in working with these girls, I was driving them to start with, and I started out as a driver and wound up taking all the girls from the company. And I was paying off law enforcement agencies to tell me what was going on in the streets. And the fact was, they called me and they said, "We're getting ready to bust you. They're all coming in. They're going to arrest all the girls and yourself." And that's when we busted up. And I was making $5,000 a night. And all of a sudden, I had nothing. I had nothing. I carried a 357 Magnum. I wore old gangster jacket. And a hat, floppy hat like Al Capone. And that's the way I live. I'd pull a gun on you in a second. I wouldn't shoot you in a second, but I'd pull a gun on you in a second. And that when we closed down, I didn't have anything to do and I didn't have any money. So me and my partner decided to go out and rob the clients. The men that we were servicing. So I picked up a gun. I picked up a gun. I picked up a gun and went and robbed seven men that night. I remember going to the door and knocking on it, and the guy saying, "Who are you?" I said, "Yeah, I'm just a delivery person." And he said, "I didn't call anybody and whatever." But some of the people wouldn't answer the door. And thank God they were very smart. But the person who cracked that door, I pushed that door open and threw them up against the wall and took everything they had. We did that seven times that night. I only got busted for one. But I don't know how in the world you could go from just a lovely young human being growing up in a world and be thrown into such doldrums of desecration and pain and suffering and bringing it upon everybody that came in contact with me. But it was that that got my attention. It got my attention, and after that, I decided to do something else. We kind of closed down and moved on, and I got busted for something else. Oh, what was it I got busted for? I know I did so many things, but it was one of the final things that kind of got me out of Virginia. I was with some friends, and we were partying, and we were all pretty high and drunk. And two of the guys were AWOL from the Navy in Norfolk. And I have to say, God had intervened in this, and it was his way of trying to take me out of a place I didn't belong and trying to show me a better way. I don't know how, but these guys were AWOL, and they said, "We're getting ready to go to Arkansas. Does anybody want to go?" And I was awake, and I said, "Sure." I didn't have anything else to do. So I just got in the car with them and went to Arkansas to their parents' house. And, they were AWOL from the Navy. The MPs came and got them, and I was stuck at their house in Arkansas with their mother and their father and his sister. And I lived there for 6 months. I don't know how, but I just lived there for 6 months. And I remember her dad said, "You need to get some work. You need to do a little something." So I got a job building some garage for somebody, and me and his daughter were hot and heavy, and she was only 17, and I was 26, and I got her pregnant, and he said, I remember her dad said, "You got to go, you got to go," and I'm like, "I have no place to go to," and I remember when I was in the penitentiary. I looked at so many magazines, and the Easy Rider magazines had so much to say about California. and all the bikes and all the women and all the things I thought were attractive to me. So I said, shoot, I'll go to California. Why not? It's a free trip, it's a bus ride. So I didn't pay attention to her being pregnant or him having a shotgun to say, you got to leave. I just said, I'll go to California. I remember calling one of the missions out there thinking I could get a bed to stay in. Well, I called them and they said, well, we won't have a bed, but we'll have a chair for you. And I'm like, okay, I didn't know what was going on in California with all the mission and all the homeless people. But I got on a bus. His father got me a ticket and got rid of me out of his house. And I got on a bus and I got out of the bus in California. And there was a cab, and I said, I need a ride to such and such mission. And he said, sure. And when I got there, I had $20 in my pocket. And I pulled it out to give to him, and he told me to keep it, that I would need it. He told me to keep it, I need it. And he was right. It's funny, I got in the line to get that chair in the mission that night, which was a line that was 2 blocks around the building. And it was only 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so I had to wait till like 6 to see if I could get a bed that night. It wasn't a bed, it was a chair, and I sat on my head on my luggage. Somebody told me in that line while I was waiting to get into that place, they said, you know, in less than 2 days, you're not going to have any of that stuff you have in your possession. It's all going to be gone. And I kind of laughed. I'm like, I'm stronger than this. I can handle this. I can carry this. I can take care of myself. And he was right. Within a week, I had lost everything I had brought with me, including them. That $20 went pretty quick. But I was on Skid Row, homeless, without anybody knowing where I was. And that was fine with me. As far as I was concerned, I had a road to where I wanted to be, which I was wrong, very wrong. But I thought for some reason it was freedom not to have to hear anybody anymore, not to be responsible for all those people I'd hurt, or see those hurt faces, or hurt my parents anymore, not thinking about anybody but myself, just purely thinking about myself. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be this. And I was. And before you knew it, you know, I was so far down that I was below the gutters. You had to dig them up to get me and find me. I was so disgusting. I slept in the streets for 3.5 years. I had learned how to live in the streets. I had learned how to live a street life. But I'll tell you, I wasn't cut out for it. And neither was most of the people down there, because it's one of the most horrible places I'd ever been in my entire life. And I've been many places that were pretty bad. And you know, there were people getting killed in doorways every night. Every night, you wake up and you walk down the street and you see somebody up in the doorway just dead. And that's just the way it was. Nobody, n human life had no purpose on Skid Row. Skid Row was a 3 block radius in Los Angeles where they kept you enclosed. And as long as you stayed within that 3 blocks, they wouldn't bother you. They wouldn't pick you up for jaywalking. They wouldn't pick you up for carrying a bottle of whiskey down the road, because it was like an open penitentiary. I mean, and that's the way it was treated. I remember being up in a room one night watching these guys drag somebody out of their car who just came down there to buy some rocks from one of the Hollywood or somewhere down to Skid Row to buy some rocks. And they tore him out of his car and threw him in the road and beat the hell out of him and ran his car into a pole. And I, for whatever reason, that clicked in my brain. It was like, I'm in the wrong place. I'm in the wrong place. And many, 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 many more things happened that were just horrific, horrific. Yet, you know, because of the life that I had led up to that part, I was able to make it up to that part. But something happened when my mom died. My mom died, in 1988. And that got me. That got me hard. That took me down. That made me cry. That made me look down inside and think about it. And I had to get back to her funeral. And I did. I flew back to her funeral. And they were having her funeral, and I got arrested at my mother's funeral for outstanding DUIs in Powhatan County. They still have my picture on the board in the jail room. So that was embarrassing. And I have to say that it put a pretty big dent on the family relations. But my sister and her brother, my brother-in-law, had become outstanding people in the county and in the family, and talked to the judge. And the judge said, asked me, he said, "How much money do you have in your pocket?" I said, "I have $200." He said, "Give it here. Get out of this town. Don't ever come back." This is where I was born. And I heard him. He's dead now, so I'm okay. But I'm saying that to say that my dad, when I got sober, I decided to get sober after getting arrested at my mother's funeral in Virginia and having to fly back with my tail between my legs, and my mama died. And I realized what progression was of alcoholism, because that's when I started to really drink. And I thought I had drank up to that time, but there was no stopping. There was every night getting to the bar and drinking until they closed, and drinking till you were passing out, just piss drunk, just so horrible, and walking down the streets back to your place and passing out. So that's what it was had amounted to. Me drinking and passing out, drinking and passing out, and drinking and passing out, and drinking and passing out. That's what it came down to. And I said, this has got to stop. And it was because of a DUI in 1980 and ASAP class that I realized maybe those people in Alcoholics Anonymous can help me. You know, nothing else can. Nobody else can. I remember some of that. Let's see. So I went to high school in Santa Monica to a group called the Pacific Group, and it was a way of life, was the name of the home group. And I remember sticking out my hand, this man grabbing my hand. He said, "Welcome home." I hadn't been welcome anywhere for years and years and years and years, nor should I have been. This man said, "Welcome home." And these people were smiling. And these people, he said, "Let me get you over here so I can talk to you." He took me over there and he set me down with somebody. And he set me down with Jim Borghese. Jim Borghese became my sponsor. And he was my sponsor for the next 8 years. He taught me how to live life on life's terms and taught me how to deal with people. He taught me how to talk. He taught me how to walk. He taught me how to spend money. He taught me how to use an ATM card. He taught me how to get a credit card. He taught me how to budget money. I remember I was living in a room that I had rented that was 7 foot by 7 foot, and my sponsor came there to pick me up to take me to a meeting. And he said, and I had a 40-ouncer in the corner where I used the bottle to pee in because I didn't have a bathroom. It was a com porch converted into a room. So I peed in the bottle. And he said, "What's that?" I said, "That's what I used to pee in." He said, "You need to get out of this room. You need to get into a better place." And I said, "I don't have any money." He said, "I'll give you the money." And I'll never forget that. That was God's intervention if I've never seen it, because people just didn't reach out and touch me like that. But I was doing the stuff. He knew I was doing the stuff. I was reaching out. I was getting numbers. I was participating. I was getting commitments at every meeting. I was mopping those floors. I was setting up those chairs. I was talking to the newcomers. I was taking people out. We were going out after meetings, having a ball. I haven't said a lot about God tonight because I told Sammy earlier today I had left God out of my talk a long time because God seemed to turn a lot of people off. But it is God who brought me through all this stuff, shining like a star, clean, calm, collected, has a house, has a dog, has a girlfriend, had two other wives. I was able in California to buy a house, start another family, have a daughter, pay for that house, have my daughter graduate from high school. And of course, my wife and I split up at about when my daughter was 18, and we've been split up ever since. But that happened because we grew apart. It happens in recovery. It happens in life. It happens when you don't talk to each other. It happens when you think you've got your life going on and he doesn't, or she's got her life going and you don't, and you separate your lives. That's what happened to us. We had a beautiful marriage. Neither one of us drank. I have 37 years. I had 37 years on May 18th of this year. I had 38 years next year. And I have to say that being a member of the Pacific Group and Alcoholics Anonymous in California was one of the most highlights of my whole entire being on the planet. They made recovery exciting, thrilling, good to be around. There was so many people in the Pacific Group. It was 1,500 people strong, and we have meetings on Wednesday nights, so 1,500 people. We have to have people running the parking lot. It's a big group. It's a big group, and you don't get lost in the big group because it's a big group of personalities that are there to help you and want to interact with you in any way they can, no matter whether you're new, old, or indifferent. They are a one-stop shop for recovery, if you ask me. But I'll tell you what, if you don't do what you're supposed to be doing in the group of the Pacific Group, you won't stick around. You can't sit in the corner there. Somebody's going to come in the corner and say, "How are you?" And then ask you a question. So I'll tell you this. I know that I should have started with this, is that we're all miracles. We're all little miracles. And if you think about a miracle, they're really fascinating because they produce things that we can't do on our own. And I know that I'm a miracle because of just the fact that I've come from Skid Row and come from all the challenges that life had to give me. In spite of all those things, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was the thing that changed my life. God and Alcoholics Anonymous will ever, forever be my waking breath. I am grateful every morning that I wake up. I don't wake up smiling every morning, but I wake up grateful every morning because I don't have to take a drink. I don't have to think about how to take a drink. I only have to think about what I'm going to have for breakfast. It's really been good to talk to you guys tonight. I feel a little off tonight. Maybe I didn't speak as well as I could, but I was glad to come out here and be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. So thanks for letting me share, and you guys have a good night.